Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. Like all the other panels of which you've seen, we're going to let each of the presenters today give their statement of their views as to the question that was put before them. The criminal justice system reform, a necessary correction, or dangerous experiment? And we begin with Heather.
Great, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on this panel of a very important topic and such distinguished panelists. So thank you very much for that. So we're here to answer two questions. Number one, are criminal justice reforms necessary? And if so, what should those reforms be? Well, when it comes to answering the first question of whether criminal justice reform is necessary, I think yes. And in answering this, you can keep in mind the fact that my experience is exclusively in the federal system as a federal prosecutor and in the leadership of the Department of Justice. So I'll bring to bear some lessons we've learned in the federal system that hopefully will be of relevance to Ohio. But the reason I think criminal justice reform is necessary is threefold. Number one, we can't afford things at the current rate. It is too expensive. In the federal system alone, since 1980, the prison population has increased by 800%. Prisons, especially when I was there, it's gotten a little bit better since, but while I was there, were extraordinarily overcrowded. And the Federal Bureau of Prison budget took up one-third of the entire Department of Justice budget. And this is a Department of Justice that is comprised of the FBI, ATF, DEA, US Marshals, all federal prosecutors, and notably for Ohio, all of the grant-making monies for state and local law enforcement and law enforcement programs. And so of all of that money we were granted by Congress, a third of it had to go to prisons because that cost was necessary. And it was getting bigger and bigger every year to where we knew that we had to do something about it because fiscally it wasn't sustainable. So that's the first reason I think we need reform. The second is that it's a public safety imperative. Every dollar that is spent housing someone in prison, and in the federal system, that's approximately $30,000 per person per year, is money not spent on law enforcement, not spent on cases involving terrorism, cybercrime, cyber hacking, child predators, large-scale financial fraud. And so if that money for some individuals, not everybody, but individuals who don't need to be there for really long prison sentences and for life can be spent on those other more impactful public safety cases, I think that's an imperative. The other aspect of the public safety reason has to do with reducing recidivism. And that is, it's a fact that 96% of all federal prisoners leave prison. It's probably similar in Ohio, I would guess. That means they return to their communities and go back on the street. And if we don't arm them with tools to be law-abiding citizens and not commit crimes again while they're in prison, that is a public safety problem. And so that's another reason that I think we have reform. And I'll get to some reforms that'll be tailored to that in a second. And the third reason is the impact that large-scale incarceration and, you know, long sentences for lower-level crimes has on communities and on confidence in the criminal justice system. Right now, there are 2.7 million children with parents behind bars. That creates a cycle of poverty and of crime that just perpetuates itself and is also a public safety problem. And when communities, especially communities of color, don't have confidence in the police because they're afraid of what they see as very long prison sentences that are unwarranted, they're less likely to cooperate in investigations and report crimes and cooperate with police. And so for those three reasons, I do think reform is necessary. Now, when it comes to what reforms are needed, I think, and I've learned in my latest job as part of a business, that it's better to focus on the most impactful things, narrow it down to a couple, and do them really well. So I think there are two things that could especially be impactful in this area. One is proportionate sentencing for low-level drug crimes. And the reason I focus on low-level nonviolent drug crimes is that in the federal system, half of our prison population was there for drug trafficking crimes or other drug crimes. So a huge portion of the cost of the Federal Bureau of Prisons was based on drugs. And so I think it makes sense to really start there. Number two, in the federal system, as you all probably know, there are very stiff penalties for drug crimes, mandatory minimums of 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and life. And those mandatory minimum penalties are not based on your role in the offense, whether you were the cartel kingpin or you were the money guy who took a bag of money from one place to another. It's based only on the quantity of drugs in the entire offense. And so you would have couriers and low-level people hit with 10, 20 year sentences or even life for very small amounts of drugs and very low-level offenses. And so creating some proportionality to that and putting people in prison for as long as they need for public safety reasons and rehabilitation reasons is going to save money in the long run that can be used for other more impactful purposes. The second area of reform that I think is necessary is investing in prison education and jobs for the formerly incarcerated. And that is purely from a public safety perspective. The United States Sentencing Commission has done studies on offender characteristics and what makes someone more or less likely to recidivate based on those characteristics. One of the starkest things in someone's background that will impact whether they commit crimes when they're released from prison or not is education level. Someone who has a high school or does not have a high school diploma is 60% likely to recidivate. Someone who has a high school diploma is 50% likely to recidivate, a 10% difference. Someone who has a little bit more education than high school, not a lot, not a degree, not even a community college degree, but just a little more training, is 40% likely to recidivate. And so there's just a stark contrast between public safety and education. Corrections is inherently a law enforcement job. We have a captive audience for the time that someone is in an institution, and we should use it to prevent crime on the outside. And so I think some of the money that can be saved from some of these incarceration, from some of these lower sentences, if lower sentences were to pass, could be put into programs like that reduces recidivism. Last thing I'll note on that point is that in the federal system, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they have a great program. It's called Federal Prison Industries, and it goes to educate prisoners and give them job training skills, very tangible skills that they can use to get jobs in manufacturing and other areas when they leave. That program reduces recidivism by over 26%. It's the most effective program in the prison. And the logic is pretty obvious. If you leave prison and you get a job, you have something to do all day, you're more likely to stay out of trouble, make some money, take care of your family. And so I think investing in programs like that are going to improve public safety outcomes on the back end. So in sum, I think yes, criminal justice reform is needed. And I think there are two areas we could focus: proportionate sentencing for low-level nonviolent drug offenders, and then using that money to invest in education and job programs so that people don't recidivate when they leave.
Thank you. Daniel.
All right. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here and speak on this important topic. I'm going to, luckily I don't have to spit out some of the statistics that were already given, but I'll talk about Ohio more specifically and some of the reforms that we've done here. So while crime trends are going up slightly now, we're still, historically speaking, at a pretty low point when we talk about crime, but there are some exceptions to that. And one notable exception is murder in Columbus. And I know that we're here, so I made you all feel really comfortable right now. But Columbus had a record number of homicides last year. And the unfortunate part of that, other than the homicides, is that nationally, only about 62% of homicides get solved. And it's my understanding that in Columbus, it's much lower than that. It's 40%. So what are we going to do about that? And what is causing that problem? Part of the problem is we don't have enough police officers. If we look at law enforcement staffing in Columbus, Columbus has about 23 police officers per 10,000 people. Just to put that into perspective, Cleveland has 37, and New York City, which has experienced historic drops in crime and especially violent crime, has 41 officers per 10,000 people. So what we're seeing is we're not investing enough in law enforcement. But like Heather said, we have limited resources. We only have so many dollars to go around. One other note, and just to hit on the violent crime aspect, is that Ohio's violent crime rate is 4 times higher than its violent crime arrest rate, meaning that there are much more crimes reported than we're actually getting arrests for. And Ohio, unfortunately, leads the nation in that category. So this realization that there's limited resources, I think, is one of the reasons why you see really strong conservative voices who have really joined this criminal justice reform movement. That's why you have people like former Attorney General Ed Meese, Orrin Hatch, Mike Lee, Rick Perry, and others who have gotten onto the criminal justice reform. I don't want to say bandwagon, but for lack of a better word, it's bandwagon. So some of the things that we've done in Ohio, we've done mens rea reform, which is critically important. Historically, every crime had two components. You had the act and you had the intent. But in this proliferation of criminal laws and criminal regulations, a lot of times the intent portion was left out. Justice Gorsuch has actually talked about this at length, and in a dissent when he was then Judge Gorsuch on the Tenth Circuit, he wrote a blistering dissent because the government didn't apply the mens rea requirement to each element of the offense. So in 2014, Ohio did the nation's first and best mens rea reform, where there is now a default reckless standard applied to criminal statutes that don't have a listed mens rea. It applies to every element, and it even went as far as any new crime that's proliferated by the legislature that doesn't have a criminal intent standard or doesn't say specifically that it's strict liability is just void. Another thing that we've done to make sure that we're only imprisoning the right people or we're not wasting resources is last year there was the Targeted Community Alternatives to Prison, where it takes felony 5 offenders, which in Ohio is the lowest level of felony. It's punishable by up to 1 year in prison. And any low-level offender, if it's a nonviolent, non-sex offense, instead of sending them to prison to serve less than 1 year, they're rehabilitated, they're treated, or possibly incarcerated in the community. And the reason that we do that is because prison is ineffective. A lot of times when we send people to prison, they come out worse than when they went in. So helping people keep ties in the community really helps them to be contributing members of society, which is really what we're trying to do. That program has been really successful. We have the lowest prison intake rate that we've had in 26 years in the state of Ohio. Our prison population recently dropped below 50,000 from a previous high of 52,000. And 50 of the counties in Ohio are voluntarily participating in the TCAP program. So one of the other things that we've done that I think is interesting for this group is civil asset forfeiture reform. Civil asset forfeiture allows civil asset forfeiture reform or civil asset forfeiture allows the government to take your property without proving that you committed a crime. They don't even have to charge you with a crime. Basically, law enforcement takes your property, they charge the property with an offense, and in a civil action where the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence, like it is in all civil cases, that's what they have to prove. If you want to get your property back, you have to actually interplead into the case between the government and your property. So in Ohio, in 2016, we did civil asset forfeiture reform, where we abolished civil asset forfeiture for anything less than $15,000. We changed it from an in rem action to an in personam action. So if the government wants to take your property, they actually have to sue you for it and raise the standard to clear and convincing evidence. And in an effort to keep Ohio's state's rights, we limited participation in the federal government's equitable sharing program. The equitable sharing program is a federal program where basically the feds say, use our easy civil asset forfeiture statute, and in exchange, we'll give you 80% and we'll take 20% off the top. So we limited that to anything over $100,000. We have other reforms in the works. Bail reform, most notably, right now our current bail system is cash centric. So basically, it is if you can afford it, you can get out. If you can't, you sit in jail. And so what a lot of jurisdictions have done is moved to these verified risk assessment tools, which calculate the risk that you'll commit a violent offense or reoffend or not show up for court, which have proven very successful. Lucas County is a county that is experimenting with that right now, and they have actually reduced violent crime committed by those awaiting trial by 40%. They're letting more people out, and they're having more people show up for court, which is exactly what we want. But I think I've probably taken my time.
Auditor Yost.
Thank you. Can you please call me? It's good to be with you all today, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you on a matter that has been of some interest to me. I want to start by telling you a story about a trial that Abraham Lincoln was involved with. And he gave an extraordinarily short closing argument. He stood up, and when it came his turn, he was defending the case, and he said, "The plaintiff has the facts right, but has the wrong conclusion," and sat down, and after a very short deliberation, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Lincoln's client. Later, he was asked, "How did you do that?" And it turned out that Lincoln, an inveterate storyteller, had been in the tavern where the jury had been dining the night before and told the story of a young farm boy who went upstairs or went into the barn, and up in the hayloft was his sister. And the hired farmhand, a young man named Ben, who were in a state of partial undress, and he immediately ran to find his father and said, "Papa, come quick before they pee all over the hay." Right facts, wrong conclusion. Well, it's beyond argument that the United States criminal justice system costs too much, imprisons too many, and for too long a time. And other speakers have already spoken eloquently to that. But I would like to speak to, I think, a couple of conclusions that may not be warranted by the evidence, and to finish by pointing out a systemic problem that I don't think has really been identified before or discussed, but ought to be. The bipartisan orthodoxy today is that we should look at ways to minimize the types of offenses that are subject to prison terms. That is, remove the possibility of prison term for nonviolent low-level offenses, and that's the rationale behind Ohio's TCAP program. Of course, even low-level felonies are still felonies, and presumably worse than misdemeanors. But a further problem with this idea is that it fails to think about the reasons that we send people to prison to begin with. Respectfully, I suggest that the advocates of the current orthodoxy have the right facts, but at least in some respects, the wrong conclusions. The generally accepted reasons for incarceration are enshrined in the Ohio Revised Code to deter the offender from similar future conduct, to deter others from similar conduct, to punish the offender, and to provide a measure of rehabilitation to those offenders whose criminal behavior rises from some shortcoming, be it addiction, upbringing, education, mental health, or the like. As a former prosecutor, I suggest that there really is yet another reason. Call it quarantine, if you like, or warehousing, if you must. But criminals commit no crimes against society at large when they're behind bars. It is an important consideration in sentencing drug offenders, for example, whose nonviolent crimes have viral results. It is also important with the small minority of criminals that accounts for a significant portion of crimes, the career criminal. And I saw them not daily, but regularly in my practice as the Delaware County Prosecuting Attorney. Merely saying that low-grade, nonviolent felonies should not be subject to prison sentences is too simple. And one of the reasons that many police and prosecutors are aghast at programs like TCAP. Statistically, one can indeed demonstrate that a low-level, nonviolent offender will generally have a better long-term outcome through a non-prison sentence. But the victim's crime are not statistics, and the fact that recidivism is generally lower in cases sentenced to non-prison sanctions is cold comfort to the victim of crime. After all, it is not the offense that goes to prison, but the offender. Unfortunately, many of my constitutionalist and conservative colleagues have drawn the wrong conclusion and are rationing prison beds rather than asking this question: who ought to be in prison and for how long? There's another practical problem. Judges around the state, like Common Pleas Judge Dave Gormley of Delaware County, who I believe is with us today, tell me that, ironically, eliminating the possibility of prison time in favor of community control sanctions makes community control sanctions less effective. Without at least the threat of a prison term, offenders on community control stop showing up for appointments, don't work their treatment programs, and simply fail at probation. But there's another more pervasive factor that complicates this question of criminal justice reform and drives up the cost, and I'd like to introduce this last idea by telling you a quick story. It was early morning at the athletic club, and bunch of men had just finished their morning workouts and were getting dressed in the locker room, and cell phone rings on one of the benches, and a fella picks it up and listens and responds, "Well, $10,000 is a lot for draperies, but the business is doing well this year. We can afford it. Go ahead." He listens a little bit longer and he says, "Well, if we do that, it's going to double the cost of that addition, but we're doing good. Let's go for it. It's our home, after all." A little bit more time, and of course, now everybody's thinking that this fellow's doing awfully well and much better than they are in their businesses, and are kind of pretending not to listen while they actually are. And he tells his wife, presumably on the other end of the phone, to go ahead and book that Chinese vacation, but 3 weeks, not just two, because it takes so long to get there. He hangs up the phone, and everybody's now just looking at him, and he says, "Whose phone is this?" One of the consideration or conclusions that I've drawn from the facts that I've seen during my public service, especially as my time as auditor of state, is that authority and responsibility must be roughly equal. This is a fundamental design principle in any organization, but it's particularly critical in government. If authority exceeds responsibility, it generates reckless behavior. If responsibility exceeds authority, it generates no behavior at all. because those who understand what needs to be done and are responsible for it are unable to do it, and the system breaks down altogether. Imagine giving one of your teenagers a credit card for which you're going to pay the bill. You give a similar credit card to the other teenager, but with the caveat that that teenager must pay the bill themselves. Which credit card balance will be higher? In our criminal justice system, responsibility and authority are not even roughly equal. This fact, the responsibility and authority are actually placed in independent branches of government. Authority is placed in the hands of judges who have little to no responsibility for their decisions. Most of the responsibility to manage the prison system and pay for it, at least, is placed with the legislature and the governor, and they have very little authority to do anything about it. Now, this is not to malign judges, far from it. Judges are actually in the best possible position to make decisions about individual offenders. They see firsthand the pathology of criminal acts and have a vast store of knowledge about human behavior. Rather, it's that the system removes one of the most important sets of variables, economic and opportunity costs, from the sentencing decision itself. It need not be so. Responsibility and authority could be made roughly equal by placing responsibility and control of the prison population under the judiciary rather than under the executive. The courts should have greater authority, not less authority, to revise sentences and or grant early release of individual prisoners within the relative needs of the system and the whole population. The courts would have to manage the prison population within the restraints and the resources that are appropriated by the General Assembly, thus creating an appropriate check and balance. In essence, if we're going to ration prison beds, shouldn't the responsibility of rationing go with those who are charged with the authority to fill them? Of course, such decisions would have to be made with with notice to the defense, the state, and the victims of crime, and include an opportunity to be heard. The day-to-day running of the prison system ought to remain with the executive, for the judicial branch has no special expertise in such things as collective bargaining or procurement, and certain matters would likely arise that would need to be heard by the judiciary. It's beyond the scope of a 10-minute talk, which I have reached my limit, to work through the details of how this could actually work, and I will be the first to admit that such a systemic change would have a lot of details that would have to be worked out. But the underlying principle remains the same, that in any organization, responsibility and authority need to be roughly congruent, and when they don't, we see the kinds of results that we've seen in the United States criminal justice system, which is runaway costs and very few opportunities to correct it. I would suggest to you that aligning responsibility and authority in Ohio would lead to more just outcomes and ultimately a better system. Thank you for having me here today.
So, responses to those openings?
That is a very intriguing thought. You're the first person I've ever heard propose an alignment of the judiciary and the prison system. And so it's rather hard to respond to right now, you know, sort of as a theoretical idea. I actually look forward to the questions after this to see if we can flesh it out a little bit more. I do think the principle underlining it of giving judges flexibility to manage more prison time for those who really need it, less prison time for those who don't, is certainly in alignment with the proposal that I have, which is to lower or even get rid of mandatory minimum sentences in the drug context, because doing so would not, you know, mean that those who need to go to prison for a really long time, and I agree with you for the on the purposes of prison, could still do so. It would just give judges more flexibility in the federal system than they have now, where there are mandatory minimum sentences that the judge doesn't have any control over. And So I do agree with you on that principle. I don't know anything about the Ohio TCAP program. I'm sorry, I don't. But I do want to be clear that my position on drug sentencing isn't to get rid of prison for drug dealers. It's about proportionate sentencing. And there are no doubt many people who need to spend time in prison, a lot of time in prison, maybe even their life in prison. But one example that's always brought to mind on the value of proportionate sentencing I can sort of give quickly, and that is someone that came to my attention when I was at the Justice Department. It was an individual who had a sixth grade education. He served in the United States Army, was honorably discharged, and developed a drug habit later, and sold crack on the street to pay for his drug habit. He had two state convictions for which he received no jail time, either time, one of which was for selling 1 ounce of cocaine. His third time he was caught doing one of these small hand-to-hand drug sales, he was prosecuted federally. And because of the federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws, the prosecutor charged him with being a third-time drug trafficking offender, and he was given mandatory life, and the judge had no discretion at all. And then that person spent the rest of his life in prison at $30,000 a year. So just to be reminded of the proportionality of sentencing point, I think I can agree with you on that. And then just one final point on the fiscal impact here, and this is something that, Daniel, I think you and I agree on. You said that there's really a need for more, or at least you insinuated there's a need for more police officers in Columbus and in certain cities in Ohio. I completely agree. I'll tell you, as a purely budgetary matter, the area that's probably been the hardest hit in the Department of Justice as a result of prison costs skyrocketing has been our state and local law enforcement grant program and our COPS program. It's shrunk immensely over the past 15 years to just a tiny fraction of what it once was. And so I would like to see that grow and to invest in state and local law enforcement on the street for that very reason.
Yeah, I'll agree with that, and I think that Auditor Yost's plan is very interesting, and I think it kind of resembles the reclaim program that we have with juvenile offenders. Right now, juvenile offenders, so we have separate juvenile courts, and in the juvenile court, the juvenile judge is responsible for their budget, and based on a formula from our juvenile justice system, they get a grant, and then for every offender, juvenile offender that they send that they are incarcerated at the state level, they have to send some of that funding back so that they can pay for that. There are certain serious offenses where they just can send them. We want them sent to juvenile services. But what we've seen is a 74% reduction in our juvenile incarceration program. Pew Charitable Trust estimates that for every dollar that we've invested in the reclaim program, the state of Ohio has actually saved $45. So I think it's certainly something to think about. And one thing I'll say about there's some legislation floating around that would impose these harsh mandatory sentences for traffickers of anything other than marijuana at any level. And it's really problematic, and it's not looking at what the outcomes are going to be. It doesn't take a look at our history, at our experience. The intent, though, behind it is good, right? We want to deter crime. We don't want these harmful drugs in our communities. But we don't judge legislation or policies based on what we hope they will do. Those people who oppose the Affordable Care Act aren't opposed to affordable health care. They just think that those policies won't get us there. And the same thing for harsh mandatory sentences. They may be well-intended, but they're just not going to do what we think that they're going to do. And we have a lot of data from the crack epidemic of the 80s and 90s to show that those policies simply don't work.
Well, I'm going to take a slightly different view from my learned colleague. While I think it's certainly possible to over-criminalize, over-penalize drug trafficking. It's a different kind of crime at this moment in time. It's epidemic. And here's the thing. Trafficking in drugs, as opposed to merely being... as opposed to merely being addicted, and quite frankly, I would support legislation that would make possession of user amounts, say less than 5-unit doses or less than 3-unit doses. I'd be in favor of making that a misdemeanor level offense. Right now, those are all felonies if it's scheduled. And there's 2,800, I think, last time I looked at the prison bed population, people in there for possession, not for dealing. And I'd like to have those beds for drug dealers. Here's why. One of the ugly little truths about opiate addiction treatment is that it has a 75% relapse rate within 6 months of the end of the 30-day treatment program. I mean, it's 3 out of 4 are going to relapse. Now, I don't want to, human hearts are notoriously difficult to heal, and opiate addiction is extraordinarily potent. But here's the thing, when that drug dealer's out there selling drugs, he or she is creating, usually a he, is creating new addicts. Making the supply line smaller, making the drugs more difficult to get, more expensive to get, will unquestionably deter some people from entering the chain of addiction to begin with, and we cannot change the slope, the trend line on this without reducing the number of people coming into addiction to begin with. If you think of a formula of N being the new number of addictions minus the product of your all the people who seek treatment times 70.75, you can't make the outcome on that slope change unless you change N. So I believe that we ought to do that. I would favor an indeterminate sentence because, you know, if we did, say, 3 to 15 years and we get the opiate thing under control, I would favor then releasing those people at the earlier part of their sentence and not holding them. But this is what I meant by quarantine. A drug dealer is a virus, and we simply cannot afford as a society to allow them to continue to affect our citizens.
We'll take questions from the room at this time.
As an auditor, I get that a lot.
Thank you.
That'll come loose. Mike Stahl from Toledo. I've actually was a public defender in Toledo. I'm one of the few people here that has done that job. And I still do work as a contract felony public defender. And I agree with Auditor Yost on, and it was actually going to be my question, reducing low-level drug felonies to misdemeanors. Yeah, but it raises another issue on, as things stand now, generally those low-level felonies will be presented to through municipal court to a preliminary hearing, which results generally in a plea to a misdemeanor. The problem with that I see is we're not effectively finding out whether these are actually crimes or whether they're just accusations. And I wonder whether that process should be reevaluated, because we all have the preliminary hearing and then also, of course, a direct indictment or an indictment after preliminary hearing. It seems like an antiquated system, and I wonder if anyone has any thoughts on that.
Well, honestly, with the echo in the room, I couldn't hardly hear what you said, except that it's something about preliminary hearings in municipal court.
That's correct. Preliminary hearings, generally, if there's a felony charge, the low-level charge, go through the preliminary hearing process in municipal court.
Before Counselor, talking off mic didn't help the problem.
If I can rephrase the question, I think what you're asking is, you're so welcome. I think what you're asking is that the current system is antiquated. should we be revising that process of transferring felony cases to the general division, to a grand jury, through the municipal court? Should we actually be looking at a different system instead of doing the hearings at municipal court?
Exactly right, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In Delaware County, we did virtually all of our indictments direct, so we've had very few preliminary hearings. I'm afraid I probably would not be a good person to have an opinion on that. I will say only that it probably makes a little bit more sense to have a common pleas judge who's much more familiar with the felony elements than a misdemeanor judge. Quite frankly, I've never had a problem with a misdemeanor judge who had a preliminary hearing, the few that we did. Now, personal experience, I guess that's a long way of saying I'm not sure and I don't know.
Daniel or Heather?
I'll just say that again, it's a problem of limited resources. In this nationally and in the state of Ohio, less than 3% of criminal cases actually go to trial. You know, they're 97% of them plead out. And, you know, so there have been some people who have written that have said, we don't really have a criminal justice system, we have a plea bargain system. So I think that resources for those courts are important, and really prioritizing what are the offenses that we want to prosecute.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar enough with your municipal courts to really comment. The federal system has a lot of process, so not sure.
Doug?
Well, hearing the panel speak to shorter sentences, and I think indeterminate sentences came up a fair amount, I wonder a little bit if this isn't a grass is always greener problem, because there was a time when we had indeterminate sentences, and then the complaints were very different outcomes for similar offenders. Sometimes the characteristics of the defenders started weighing into prison sentences, you know, racial impacts, things like that, and there was a lot of concern to make it more uniform and get rid of the disparity. And now we've gone to a system, at least in the federal sentencing guidelines, where we get a lot more uniformity, and now people are saying, oh, wasn't it wonderful when we had the ability to have disparate sentences? Is this just a pendulum that swings back and forth, and we become more aware of the problems that are sort of associated with whichever system we have at a given time, whether it's more determinate or less determinate?
That's a really good question. I think there's probably a middle ground. Reducing or eliminating mandatory minimums in a statute, but still maintaining some sort of consistency for judges through something like the sentencing guidelines, at least in the federal system, I think has made a lot of sense post-Booker. By and large, most judges want mandatory minimums to be reduced or in some cases eliminated to give them more discretion. The guidelines tend to be a lot lower than the mandatory minimum, so it means that they're sort of happy with the guidelines, which would create consistency, but not so much with tying their hands through a statute that they see as more draconian for some offenders. And so I think it's a very good question. There's probably a middle ground to be used. I mean, one of the other things about determinate sentencing that I think, at least in the federal system, a lot of people liked was getting rid of parole and really know when you're gonna leave and having just a system of good time credits. Now, there are some ways around that too. There's compassionate release where the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons can move for a defendant to be released early. Typically, that's done on health grounds or sort of infirmity and old age. And then recently, there was a big release under clemency, where a lot of low-level drug offenders were released early due to presidential clemency. And so I think we can probably look at those two things that have been used in the past couple of years to see what it did. And in more, because that's more indeterminate than determinate sentencing, letting people out early. But it happened so recently, we haven't really seen the full effects of it yet, so we can look at it and see how it went. But I do think there's a middle ground where you can give judges more flexibility in a statute, but then also have the guidelines that they can deviate from in extreme cases.
So, you know, I think Ohio got rid of, in 1995, the indeterminate sentences, part of the Truth in Sentencing Act. And I think there was a reaction to a variety of things, disparate sentencing patterns, as well as very profoundly the way the system at that time disenfranchised victims and treated them as, if at all, an afterthought and frequently ignored them. That culture has changed dramatically in the last 20 years, and victims' rights are now part of the lexicon in every court. There's victims' advocates in most criminal courts and a lot of the law enforcement agencies. So I think that maybe we could go back and retool and look at some usefulness for indeterminate sentences while maintaining our concern. Another way that the world has changed is the vast availability of data. In 1995, information technology was light years away from where it is now. Florida just passed a law requiring the collection of a great deal of granular data. I think modern data mining techniques could go a long way to alleviating concerns about the disparate sentencing, which frankly I think population density probably would turn out, just my guess, to be far and away the most important variable in sentencing disparities. But we ought to all want a system where the crime is treated the same, whether regardless of where it happens. And I think that there's several things that we can and should do, including some indeterminate sentence provision.
So I'm pretty excited about what I just heard. I think data collection is really, really important. I mean, how do we know whether what we're doing is working and we're getting the outcomes we want unless we're measuring data? And unfortunately, in the state of Ohio, we don't have a unified court system, so every county counts things in their own system, and on top of that, we're not using standardized definitions, so that's really problematic. But going to the indeterminate sentencing issue, I'm a huge fan of indeterminate sentencing. I think if you look at two of the purposes of sentencing, which are rehabilitation and incapacitation, that those are best served by an indeterminate sentencing structure. During using a determinate sentencing structure, no matter what you do in prison, if you sleep, if you you know, if you just sleep the whole time, if you get in fights or whatever, you're going to get out at the same time. We're not encouraging rehabilitation, which we can do in an indeterminate sentence. And then on the other side of it, people who really are problematic, who are violent in prison, are going to be violent and problematic when they get out of prison. So let's keep them there longer on the back end. So I'm a big fan of indeterminate sentencing.
Matthew Byrne, I want to shift just a little bit and ask you about an issue that affects the criminal justice system, but maybe is not actually part of the criminal justice system, and that is employment. We've seen more and more states, and actually more and more municipalities or counties, pass ban the box statutes, which isn't something you've mentioned today, but I think it relates a little bit to this issue of education that Heather Childs raised. Obviously, more education, you have more likelihood of getting a better, stabler job, et cetera. And we have this trend where we have more cities and counties and some states passing these ban the box statutes, which effectively prevent employers from asking questions about criminal backgrounds or criminal convictions prior to a certain point in the hiring process. And it seems that there's been a something of a coming together of people on different sides of the spectrum. Where it started off, I'd say, kind of on the left talking about this issue, but you now have the Koch brothers and their network really making a big push for ban the box statutes. What are your thoughts on whether and if and how those statutes might be advisable or inadvisable, how they might affect some of the concerns you've raised with criminal incarceration rates, et cetera, and recidivism. And also, I'm just curious as well, you know, as somebody who works with employers, especially national employers, who sometimes have trouble balancing not only dealing with these statutes in a patchwork across the country, but also trouble dealing with how do I make sure that I comply with these statutes and don't ask too many questions about criminal convictions, but also, on the other hand, how do I comply with my obligation to not engage in negligent hiring, which kind of creates a conflict for employers around the country. So any thoughts you have are appreciated.
That's a great question. So just to flesh out Ban the Box a little bit, some of the areas where I've seen it done and I think the most effective are areas in which employers cannot ask about criminal convictions on the first employment application. Basically, when they get the paperwork in and screen who they then want to process further or interview. But then later on down the road, they can certainly ask about it. And the reason for that isn't to tell employers you must hire the formerly incarcerated. It's to say we don't want you to automatically eliminate people in the very first round only because they're incarcerated when you otherwise would think that they are qualified and would be good at the job. You can at least have the chance to meet them, look at their credentials, and figure out if their former crime has anything to do with this job whatsoever, or if they would be perfectly fine with and good with it and have a second chance. And so it's to eliminate that just first screening bias. But I don't think it should be, at least in the versions that I've heard of, keep the employer from hiring who they really think is best fit for the job. And so considering that, and also considering the fact that, as I've seen it, there are certain jobs that are exempt, like law enforcement and national security related jobs from the Ban the Box initiatives, I would favor that just because it gives the formerly incarcerated more of an opportunity to be seen as somebody who has turned their life around, has the skills for the job, and can do it. Because there are plenty of jobs out there that formerly incarcerated individuals, depending on their prior crime and their experience, perfectly good at doing and would do well.
So I'll disagree a little bit. I think that Ban the Box is good when a private employer chooses to do it itself. And a lot of big employers have chosen to do that, Google, Coke Industries, among others. And I think that's great, that's fantastic. But unfortunately, what we've seen is places that have passed statutes, the people who it hurts the most are minorities with no criminal record, because they're not being called back for the second interview, because implicit or explicit, there's this bias that this is a young minority, they probably have a criminal record, which is unjust and unfair, but that's the unfortunate reality that the data has shown.
You know, I support reentry. I mean, we used to have a phrase when I was a young man that so-and-so had paid their debt to society. I think it's been decades since I have heard anybody say that, and I don't believe in throwing away people. But on the other hand, there's a reason why a conviction for a prior bad act is available for cross-examination in a court of law. Why is that? Because it goes to the individual's believability. And certainly, within some period of time, a prior conviction ought to be something that a person could consider in making a hire where it's that's going to be an issue. So I'm nervous about some of the talk that I hear. What I would prefer to see is some kind of a ceiling, not an expungement, that after a period of time of good behavior, that the record could still exist, but it would only be reopened upon a subsequent arrest or some kind of issue like that. We need all of our citizens to be productive and have a shot when they get out of prison to be able to be productive and contribute to our society. But I'm concerned that we're running toward a period where we're going to say a criminal conviction doesn't matter, and it really does. It just really does.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question about that, actually? Because I saw this in sort of laws that were proposed on juvenile record expungement. And so in the case where you think that a record could be sealed after a period of time of good behavior, what would that person answer on the employment application as to whether they have a criminal record or not?
Well, it would depend on what the legislature passed.
What do you propose? I'm just curious.
And I don't have a bill to propose. I mean, this is something that people that are smarter than me would debate for a long time to come up with a just way to do it. But since you brought that up, let me explain the difference between a sealing and an expungement. In an expungement, it just goes away. Not only is the record erased, they shred the file. It's done forever, and I don't support that. However, a sealing means that the record for public consumption at some point becomes unavailable, but it still can be reopened on application of certain people. There's a controlled, probably a BCI and I would be where the index would be kept of sealed records. So it wouldn't exist at your local county courthouse anymore, but there would be an opportunity where that information to become relevant later would be available to law enforcement on a subsequent offense.
And I think that's right. We support sealing over expungement as well. I think that's the right way to do that.
So I am told we have time for one more question. Sir?
Hi. Thanks for the panelists today. Ms. Childs mentioned that one-third of the Justice Department budget, I guess, goes to prisons and keeping people in prison and maintaining it. But I'm wondering if each of you could speak briefly from a policy standpoint about, the common argument is that we need to reduce sentences and get people out of prison and the cost will go down. But what about preventing people from getting involved in drugs and things like that? Because then the prison population would be decreased to begin with, and then the money would be freed up for another purpose. Thanks.
I agree with that. And I would agree investing in those crime prevention purposes, both with the incarcerated and, in schools and with younger individuals before they have an opportunity to commit crimes.
And I think that it goes to the need for more police. So what the biggest deterrent for somebody to commit crime is not the punishment down the road, it's their perception of the probability of capture. It's, do they think that they're going to get caught? And so I think investing in police and having them do these community policing programs. I mean, Columbus in the neighborhood of Linden did a community policing program and they reduced gun violence by 40%. That's what reduced it. It was not 6 months from now, I may go in front of a judge and they may sentence me to a long time. It was to a long prison sentence. It was, I may get caught by this police officer now.
I agree with that too.
I disagree with that, Daniel. And based on my experience, we had a very highly sophisticated fake ID theft ring that was working the Polaris area, which is adjacent to an unincorporated area in Delaware County that you would never know you had left the city of Columbus. And they were hitting the Lewis Center area, thinking that they were still in Columbus. And when we did the bust and were doing the first interview, it was amazing to see their jaws drop when they argued with us. No, we stayed in Columbus. We didn't want to go into Delaware County, basically because, we're all crazy there. But I think people do worry about what the penalty is. Here's the thing. We shouldn't be talking about whether we're going to reduce sentences. What we should be talking about is who should be in prison and how long should they be there. Thank you.
I'm now told one more.
I wanted to pick up on a comment that the auditor made about giving folks a shot to be reentered into society and making a solid contribution. If we look at some of the earlier comments talking about training and so forth, it really goes to what we know about reentry, which is if you want people to reenter successfully, they need to get a job. And one of the biggest problems in terms of individuals getting jobs, oftentimes it's not something that has to do specifically with the criminal justice system, it has to do with the regulatory system in the state, which is to say, how many hurdles do we put, not just in front of people who have criminal records, but in front of individuals in general to be licensed to participate in a particular occupation. There was a recent study done that showed that Ohio does not fare well when it comes to the number of regulations. The Mercatus Center found that we had about 100,000 more mandates than the average state in our regulatory code. What is it that Ohio needs to do to be competitive in terms of allowing people to participate in jobs in a way that will actually have a meaningful contribution to these individuals being able to be reincorporated and become successful members of society?
Thank you.
Since that's my boss, I guess I better answer. So I think that's exactly right. You know,
that was each of us.
Sean, each of you see how that's done?
That was a really good answer. You want to stop?
So each. I was in a conversation with somebody who was formerly incarcerated, and he said that, you know, each of us is on probation in some way or another. We have a place that we have to show up Monday through Friday for a certain number of time, and we have somebody that we report to, right? We have a job, so that is important. And I think one of the biggest ways that we can remove barriers to that is occupational licensing reform. We have so many occupations that we have to be licensed for in our order to do. And so for example, one of the biggest training programs that they have in prisons is for HVAC, working on HVAC. Well, unfortunately, in Ohio, if you're convicted of certain things, you aren't eligible for an HVAC license. So we're training people to get these jobs, and we get their hopes up, and even if they are determined to be contributing members of society, we close the door on them once they get out. So that's really unfortunate. I think that would be the biggest step is occupational licensing reform.
I agree with that, and the collateral sanctions in Ohio law that have no nexus with the offense at all are really a state scandal. I hope that while I'm in public office, I see a reform where the any collateral sanction that is attached to a criminal act has to have some direct relationship with it. I would go so far as to say that we ought to do something close to strict scrutiny to determine whether a collateral sanction is an appropriate addition or appropriate punishment to a criminal act because of the downstream effects on society and the individual's liberty.
I agree. For example, about 3 or 4 years ago, the American Bar Association did a project to catalog all of the state collateral consequences and federal collateral consequences of incarceration, and there are just hundreds of thousands of them. I mean, for example, in some states, you can't be a barber if you have a criminal record.
Well, that concludes the panel. So thank you very much.